Islamic Arts Program is a part of, was an under-resourced area for funding, and they actually offered extra grants aimed at shoring up that industry. It was one of the first times that I ever remembered that the NEA actually offered two grants during a calendar year. Usually organizations can only apply for one program, but they actually, you could apply for two if one of them was a media arts project. So the NEA gave priority funding because media arts was considered important and vital and an area of the arts that looked to the future, and they decided that it deserved extra funding. So the fact that that there's a local program that is being diminished is it kind of sad on that front.
And Music Portland is conducting a survey, is that right?
Yeah, so Music Portland has been conducting a survey that's aimed at, say, professional musicians and people around the industry in order to assess, what types of experience is necessary. I think that the PCC administration was trying to figure out, so do people need this degree in order to be able to get jobs? Is that a part of the necessary requirement? But a lot of people in the department claim that, well, this is a creative process. It's not, it's an important aspect to arts creativity and knowledge, but actually nailing down whether employers look for that degree is another matter. PCC Sonic Arts Program brings on 19 full and part-time faculty members that would be affected by these cuts.
If our listeners are interested in finding out more about these Oregon Arts Watch stories we've been talking about, what's the best way for them to do that?
You can read all these stories and more at Oregon Arts Watch at orartswatch.org.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Althea.
That was Laura Grimes, the executive director of Oregon Arts Watch, speaking with me about some of the latest stories from the publication. More information is online at orartswatch.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and Monkey Presents, welcoming Nils Fromm this Tuesday at the Schnitzer Hall. The German experimental pianist and composer combines both classical and electronic elements. Nils is touring behind his latest record and playing songs from his whole career. More info and tickets at portland5.com.
We are not American! We are not American! We are not American! We are not American! Say it in your heart! Say it when you sleep! We are not American. We will die as Hawaiians. We will never be Americans. The Americans, my people, are our enemies. And you must understand that. They are our enemies. They took our land. They imprisoned our queen. They banned our language. They forcibly made us a colony of the United States. America always says they are democratic. Lies! That is a lie! They have never been democratic with nations.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Santiago Ortega, and this is Radio Zine. So I had a I had started a piece that I'm working on right now, but it wasn't coming together in time, and so I wanted to try a little something. So the person you just heard was a Hawaiian activist named Haunani K. Trask, and you know, I figure since we just celebrated Mother's Day this past Sunday, I wanted to lift up the revolutionary mothers. You know, I never knew her in life, but I knew people who knew her, who were, you know, who had worked with her. And, you know, I bought her book, a native daughter, drawing a blank on the entire thing, but she wrote a book about being a native daughter. And, and her words, you know, right now really ring true. You know, when she says we are not Americans, I mean, you know, people right now, especially in this time, you know, they're trying to figure out how to fight this fascist threat that we have on our hands. And, you know, and a lot of liberals would have you believe that, you know, when we're talking about fighting the fascists, that we just need to be more patriotic, that we just need to be more American. But I mean, my contention with that is that what does that look like from the perspective of people who've never been considered Americans? You know, Malcolm X had a really great, he said something really great about the fact that if you have to be legislated for in order to have your humanity recognized, to be able to have, you know, to have rights, then you're not really a citizen. You're not really an American. And, you know, especially with what we have going on right now, you know, the foundations of what allows black and brown folks to be able to vote and participate in the society is not undergirded by a deep compassion from the state to be able to give us those rights, but it was legislated through blood, sweat, and tears and lives, if we're being honest, on account of being able to have the little concessions that we got. And what does that mean as black and brown folks to be able to be American, to be, you know, to how does that affect us is kind of what I want to put out there. And another thing I was looking at too is that, you know, there's a quite a few think pieces about how there is a less visible amount of black folks at these hands-off protests and these 50-51 protests, and how, you know, especially from the people who are kind of the thought leaders in a lot of communities around the country that I speak to, that you know, they're just tired. You know, I mean, they get out into the streets. They're fighting not only for the rights of their own people, but ostensibly they're looking towards the betterment of everyone. And the movements of black folks and brown folks too, our movements get co-opted and pulled back into essentially the Democratic Party. You know, we saw it with Black Lives Matter, we saw it with Defund the Police, we saw all these really great movements that were making headway that had potential to really change a lot of things in this country in terms of how, not only how black and brown folks are treated, but how everyone is treated by undercutting the base of what gives a lot of these reactionary structures within capitalism to be able to undercut them a bit. And rather than having people jump in, you know, having more than just the affected communities jump in, you know, white liberals, white progressives in particular, speaking of both, you know, rather than being able to embrace the fact that, you know, we need to dismantle certain pieces of the system because they're not only are they harming people in marginalized communities, but it eventually harms us. Rather than taking that stance, it's like they're so dedicated to law and order that they end up shooting themselves in the foot. And So, I mean, and, you know, especially right now, you know, we hear a lot of people saying we're going to lose our democracy. Well, I would say that, like, what is democracy to people who have never been treated as citizens? You know, they're talking a lot. You know, I've seen Stephen Miller in the news talking about how he wants to suspend habeas corpus. And, you know, and white liberals and white conservatives are losing their minds. But, I mean, habeas corpus is momentarily suspended all the time in terms of how black and brown people are treated and how they respond, especially to authority, particularly to police. Habeas corpus is suspended all the time. You know, that's how we end up getting people, you know, shot and killed and disappeared. Habeas corpus, you know, we just celebrated, you know, just did a remembrance of missing and murdered indigenous women not too long ago, you know, with Cinco de Mayo. And habeas corpus is suspended all the time in terms of indigenous women. You know, there's no recognition. People are disappeared all the time. We don't, as black and brown folks, we are given those rights on paper, but when it becomes convenient to preserving law and order, it's suspended. It's not, it doesn't take a court decree to do it, you know? So I guess I want to put out the phone number. The phone number here is 503-231-8187. And I want to put it out. So to the white folks who are under the sound of my voice or can hear me right now, I want to talk about, like, from your perspective, what democracy are we losing? And I'm not saying this, and I'm saying this as somebody who is a part of communities who have been affected generation after generation before civil rights and after civil rights, in terms of how much democracy we really have outside of that community. And then to, you know, to my black and brown brothers, sisters, siblings, you know, I want to, you know, talk to me about your experience with these protests, if you've been to them. I've been to one, and it was a real turnoff because, you know, I don't see any point in being chummy with cops at a protest, because, you know, cops are like the white blood cells of the capitalist body, if you will. And when something gets in and threatens, the white blood cells mobilize. So if the white blood cells aren't mobilizing to eliminate something, then clearly there isn't a threat there. And because so many of the people involved in these hands-off protests are older white folks who are potentially losing their Medicare, their Social Security, there's a lot more sympathy around that, rather than whenever somebody gets killed in cold blood by the cops and goes into the street, because it just doesn't have there's a loss of life, but it doesn't apparently have the same gravitas when we're talking about who's affected and what the potential outcomes of the system may be. So once again, just to reiterate, to the white folks out there, you know, what democracy are we losing? I want to talk about that. And to my black and brown folks who are listening, talk to me about your experiences with these protests. Tell me how you feel about the current state of things, because I really want to know. There's so many of us out here who are just exhausted, and especially when you've read enough history to know we've been here multiple times and we've given multiple times, you know, and it seems like, you know, we give in service of, you know, the lesser evil, quote unquote, and then we are put last every time because there's always something more pressing to deal with. So I just want to throw that out there. So there's a portion of one of Malcolm X's speeches I wanted to read, and then we'll check and see if we got some callers. He says, so this is from his Ballot or the Bullet. And he says, no, I'm not an American. I'm one of the 22 million black people who are the victims of Americanism. One of the 22 million black people who are victims of democracy. Nothing but disguised hypocrisy. So I'm not standing here speaking to you as an American or a patriot or a flag saluter or a flag waver. No, not I. Okay, let me finish this, and then I see America through the eyes of the victim. I don't see any American dream. I see an American nightmare. It was the black man's vote that put the present administration in Washington, D.C. Your vote, your dumb vote, your ignorant vote, your wasted vote put an administration in Washington, D.C. that has seen it fit to pass every kind of legislation imaginable, saving you until last, then filibustering on top of that. And you and your and my leaders have the audacity to run around clapping their hands and talk about how much progress we're making. And if he wasn't good in Texas, he sure can't be good in Washington, D.C., because Texas is a lynch state. It is the same breath in the same breath as Mississippi. No different. Only they lynch you in Texas with the Texas accent and lynch you in Mississippi with the Mississippi accent. And these black leaders have the audacity to go and have coffee with in the White House with a Texan, a Southern boy, and all he is, that's all he is, and then come out and tell you and me that he's going to be better for us since he's from the South and he knows how to deal with Southerners. That's just a little piece of it. So it sounds like we do have a call on the line. Caller, how are you doing today?
Well, I'm all right.
Good.
I'm over in just blocks away from your broadcast studio. I'm so grateful that you're speaking about these things. Thank you, Santiago.
Hey, no problem. So what's on your mind, my brother? What's going on?
I was reminded that it was Obama that initially suspended habeas corpus, and that basically the liberals have been doing it to us for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he did. Not only did he suspend habeas corpus, but he also was he also approved the use of the National Guard during the Ferguson protests. So essentially, using the National Guard as a police. So yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And
that's right. All of the use of the executive's office as increasing its power, and then, of course, turning it over, thinking that he would never possibly lose. This is a very neoliberal thing to do, is assume that they're always going to be in power.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And, you know, and I think that's a really good point, because a lot of what we see, they don't actually believe it'll be used on those with privilege, because they're strictly looking at protecting their own person. But they don't see, they're only looking at the short term. They're not seeing in the long term how that could affect everyone else. So if you're suspending habeas corpus because the modern day lynching of black folks is causing such an uproar that it's disturbing the peace, and you suspend habeas corpus for people who you think that most folks won't even care about, you don't understand that switch can be flipped on you now, since you manufactured the ability to flip it. It's a very good point.
Yeah, you got it. And it will continue down this path until we find a way to get some leverage, some power. We want politicians to actually be fearful of us and enact policies that we like, so that they do not have, they can sleep at night.
Yes, exactly. And that's the key point. You know, they need to fear. And I believe what we're missing is like a revolutionary workers' party, because the Democratic Party is where things are, where, you know, revolutions go to die. You know, they take defund the police, which means like take money from the police and stop giving them power, and saying, well, maybe reinvest in the police, maybe reeducate the police. You know, when police don't need education, they already know what they're doing. You know, or Black Lives Matter becomes, you know, it becomes like, oh, well, that's just the first part of the conversation. It's like, no, this is, yeah. So, you know, you're right about that. And so can I ask you a question? Are you white, or are you black or brown?
Yeah, it's fascinating you ask me. I was reading a book on James Baldwin today, and he was talking about the power and pain of identifying as white, because my skin is pretty light. I mean, anyone looking at me is going to tell me I'm white, and I can't argue that, and I don't mind.
Yeah.
It. But I do love the idea of being able to transcend the identification of race to some degree, that we can find something more powerful and more unifying than just seeing ourselves as a skin tone.
Well, and see, and here's my point. So I see, and I feel you. And so what I always tell, especially because I'm lighter skinned Chicano, you know, so I'm, you know, so I understand. And so what I tell people is that you don't get to choose your DNA, but you do get to choose your politics. And white, you know, white not only is a skin color, but it's also like proximity to power. So when so I would say, like, you know, I say worker, because we're, you know, even because you almost have to be like a class, what do they call it, class traitor, you know, in order to shed that. And so when we're talking about that, we're talking about, like, you know, socialist organizing or communist organizing. I think what you would be looking for is like worker, but also class traitor, because you're actively every day attempting to shed that which gives you benefit. So what was your name again, brother?
I'm Phil.
All right, Phil. Well, I want to thank you for calling in. I really appreciate your input, and you know, and keep on that road, man. You know, you have a really good understanding, and I really appreciate, you know, what you had to say. And I just want you to know I really appreciate you. Have a good night, man.
Thank you, Santiago. One more point. Monday the 19th is the 100-year anniversary of the birth of Malcolm X.
Hey, yeah. All power to the people, man. Yes, sir. Yeah.
All right.
Thank you for pointing that out. Yeah. Yeah, no, that was, yeah. Thank you, Phil. That's the thing is that, you know, the Trump can't pull these levers if there wasn't levers to pull. How do those levers exist? You have to ask yourself. Because he can't manufacture them out of nothing. They were already there. You know, especially when we're talking about mass deportations like we're seeing now, mass deportations go way back. I mean, I have friends down in Los Angeles where, you know, they have family that were affected by some of the first mass deportations. They didn't call them deportations, though. They called them repatriations. You know, we're talking about the 1930s, where they're just about 40 or 50 years removed from the Treaty de Guadalupe Hidalgo, where, you know, so that happened on February 2nd, I believe that was 1849. And basically, it's what cleaved the lower five Southwest states from Mexico after the American War of Aggression against Mexico, and so these families, they have family directly on the other side of the border. They're separated by an imaginary border that only allows money to cross but doesn't allow people, and we are treated ostensibly different, not even just by the people who created the line to begin with, but also by our own family being separated by often by distance, but now often by time, because so many of us have become so Americanized. And we have to understand that these things don't come out of thin air. Trump can't do what he's doing if there wasn't a mechanism for it. Now, the way he does it might be more bald-faced and more aggressive, more racist, and definitely fascist, but it doesn't take away from the fact that it exists. I just read a, before Phil came on, I was reading a piece from Malcolm X, a little excerpt from his Ballad and the Bullet, and then there's another piece here that I wanna read. It's so Kwame Ture, otherwise known as Stokely Carmichael, you know, he wrote a piece called Combating Liberalism, and he distinguishes liberalism from socialism in that liberalism is dedicated to private property and to securing private profits, whereas socialism talks about property being held in common and, you know, not working towards profit but producing for need. And so He says, so here's an excerpt from him. He says, now, I think that the biggest problem with the white liberal in America and perhaps the liberal around the world is that their primary task is to stop confrontation, stop conflicts, but not to redress grievances, but to stop confrontation. And this is very clear. It must become very, very clear in all of our minds, because once we see that the primary task of the liberal is, then when we... Because once we see what the primary task of the liberal is, then we can see the necessity of not wasting time with them. Their primary role is to stop confrontation, because the liberal assumes a priori that a confrontation is not going to solve the problem. This, of course, is an incorrect assumption. We know that. We need not waste time showing that this assumption of the liberals is clearly ridiculous. I think history has shown that confrontation in many cases has resolved quite a number of problems. Look at the Russian Revolution, look at the Cuban Revolution, look at the Chinese Revolution. In many cases, stopping confrontation really means prolonging suffering. The liberal is so preoccupied with stopping confrontation that he usually finds himself defending and calling for law and order, the law and order of the oppressor. Confrontation would disrupt the smooth function of society, so the politics of the liberal leads him into a position where he finds himself politically aligned with the oppressor rather than with the oppressed. The reason the liberal seeks to stop confrontation, and this is a second pitfall of liberalism, is that his role, regardless of what he says, is really to maintain the status quo rather than to change it. He enjoys the economic stability from the status quo, and if he fights for the change, he is risking his economic stability. What the liberal is really saying is that he hopes to bring about justice and economic stability for everyone through reform, that somehow the society will be able to keep expanding without redistributing the wealth. This leads to the third pitfall of the liberal. The liberal is afraid to alienate anyone, and therefore he is incapable of presenting any clear alternative. What the liberal really wants is to bring about change which will not in any way endanger his position. The liberal says, it is a fact that you are poor, and it is a fact that some people are rich, but we can make you rich without affecting those who are rich. I do not know how poor people are going to get economic security without affecting the rich in a given country, unless one is going to exploit other peoples. I think if we follow the logic of the liberal to its conclusion, we would find that all we get from this is that in order for society to become equitable, we must begin to exploit other peoples. And the final part here, fourth, I do not think that liberals understand the difference between influence and power. Liberals get confused seeking influence rather than power. Conservatives on the right wing or the fascists understand power, though, and they move to consolidate power while the liberal pushes for influence. That's not the whole thing. It's just an excerpt. But yeah, I mean... And Kwame Ture wrote this in the 60s, and I bring up this because we're dealing with this stuff now. We have more people seeing it now, but when Kwame Ture was talking about this while he was still within this country, people were not listening to him. He was just looked at as some uppity black person who was just causing a ruckus and trying to make the situation unlivable for everyone. But black and brown folks saw fascism a mile away because it already happened to us. The expansion of manifest destiny from the East Coast to the West Coast, in terms of what they call the pioneers and the westward expansion. You know, when the conquistadors came from Spain to Central and South America, they were different in application, but they were not different in principle. And we see a lot of the same things across the entire continent. I mean, the same could be said about the French who went across Canada. You know, we experienced the brunt of fascism. We just were so far removed from it that we don't think of it as fascism. You know, we've had time to change the narrative, to be able to say, they weren't being evil. They came across the ocean and they sold off the last of their belongings to look for a better life in a new place. They were the pilgrims coming over on the Mayflower. They have all these flowery ways of being able to downplay what was actually, I mean, fascism and genocide. It happened so long ago that people find ways to put it off on something else. So once again, this is Radio Zine. My name is Santiago Ortega, and so right now we're having a discussion here. To the white folks who are listening, I wanna ask you about what democracy are we really losing? Because as I read some excerpts from Kwame Ture and Malcolm X, who will be celebrating his 100th birthday on Monday. Talking about how as black and brown, I mean, particularly them as black folks, but I would say as black and brown folks collectively, we saw how the democracy of America has always been a hypocrisy. It's just that because what's affected us has not affected the whole of the population. And by the whole of the population, I mean, it hadn't reached white liberals quite yet. And so it could be brushed off to the side. But now that everybody's finally feeling the strain of the American imperialism come home to roost as fascism, now the warning signs are up. So anyway, so I'm inviting people to call in and have a discussion. We had a brother Phil call in, and he had a lot of good points to make. So the phone number here is 503-231-8187. Kwame Ture and Malcolm X, and even to an extent Martin Luther King, while he's considered much more of a what you would say like an integrationist figure, he after all the work he had done, to get black folks integrated in society, he had lamented that he had felt that he had integrated his people into a burning building. And his politics became more radical, especially as he talked to, people who were more involved in, black power struggle, Kwame Ture, or Stokely Carmichael, as he was known, because he was a part of the protests down there in the South. But, as he began to speak to more of those people, he began to understand that, it's not just a simple notion of just bringing about change through reforms, because the reforms won't stick without something bigger, as we're seeing now. Richard Wolf, Democracy at Work, if you look on YouTube, he just did a piece about reform versus revolution, playing on the piece written by Rosa Luxemburg in 1900. And TLDR, he says it's not reform or revolution, it's reform and revolution, because the reforms won't stick without revolution. And that's what we're seeing now, is that, when we had those reforms, we had to keep pushing to change the whole. It's like altering a dress or altering a garment. You can only alter so much before you have to say it's time to get a new garment. And when we get to the point where the new garment, we're supposed to get it, somebody talks you out of it, and so you end up wearing this thing that just falls apart because it's literally just made of alterations. There's threads hanging, pieces hanging everywhere, and it just looks a mess. And should have gotten the new piece when we had a chance. So anyway, I want to put that phone number out there again, 503-231-8187. Come and join the discussion. I want to hear from you, white folks. I want to hear, what democracy are we losing? How are you feeling about this situation? Black and brown folks, tell us if you've been a part of the protests lately with 50-51 or Hands Off. Tell me about your experience down there, and tell me about what you're doing in the community to address what's going on. So there is there's another piece here. There's another piece I want to read. It's a little bit from Mao on his piece on combating liberalism. He says, "We stand for active ideological struggle because it is the weapon of ensuring unity within the party and the revolutionary organizations in the interest of our fight. Every communist and revolutionary should take up his weapon. But liberalism rejects ideological struggle and stands up for unprincipled peace, thus giving rise to a decadent Philistine attitude and bringing about political degeneration in certain units and individuals in the party, like the revolutionary organization. Liberalism manifests itself in various ways. To let things slide for the sake of peace and friendship when a person has clearly gone wrong, and refrain from principled argument because he is an old acquaintance and a fellow townsman, a schoolmate, a close friend, a loved one, an old colleague, or an old subordinate. Or to touch on the matter lightly instead of going into it thoroughly so as to keep on good terms. The result is that both the organization and the individual are harmed. This is one type of liberalism. To indulge in irresponsible criticism in private instead of actively putting forward one suggestion to the organization. To say nothing to people in their faces but to gossip behind their backs, or to say nothing at a meeting to gossip afterwards. To show no regard for all the principles of collective life but to follow one's own inclination. This is the second type. To let things drift if they do not affect one personally. To say as little as possible while knowing perfectly well what is wrong. To be worldly and wise and play safe and seek only to avoid blame. This is a third type. Not to obey orders, but to give pride of place to one's own opinions. To demand special consideration from the organization, but to reject its discipline. This is a fourth. So what he's talking about here is he's talking about specifically within the revolutionary organizations, because one thing that liberalism really plays on is pluralism. And when Kwame Ture was talking about how he, you know, the white liberal seeks to not alienate anyone, what he's talking about essentially is pluralism, where, you know, people like to say, oh, you know, so-and-so is not a monolith, or, you know, we're not a monolith, or, you know, there's the or as like Ben Shapiro would say, the marketplace of ideas, right? You know, or like the people say, I don't agree with what you say, but I defend your right to say it. Yeah, it's pluralism. You know, it's like saying, or both sidesism. You know, like saying there's both sides to a genocide, or saying there's both sides to a racist action that's being taken by your local police department. It's allowing for a plurality of opinions that ultimately, at the end of the day, do nothing to actually solve the problem itself, and in a lot of ways, actually go towards protecting the power structures that you're actively trying to fight against. That is essentially how pluralism works. And so when liberals talk about how, you know, like, you know, communists or socialists, like there's no room for opinions, or there's no room for looking for another way. It's not saying that, you know, we don't have like arguments, or that we don't have discussions about what a certain action will be, or what a certain opinion will be held by the party or an organization, because we as communists and socialists do have those discussions, but at the end of the day, you support a united front that's based in principle and not just on your own needs. And that's what we see from a lot of this stuff, especially as we look throughout history, why a lot of the gains that were made through the civil rights struggle were eventually abandoned, is because there was through liberalism, there was an allotment of a pluralism of opinions, and those opinions ultimately led towards undercutting what gains were made. You know, we can see it now, you know, because there was no revolution to be able to lock into stone the gains of the civil rights movement, to lock in the gains of fighting for fighting for abortion rights, to lock in the gains of women being able to have autonomy, because there ultimately was no revolution to lock those things into stone. Now we have somebody in power who was willing to rip out the wiring, or to rip apart the shoddy patchwork of the reforms. And so when we're talking about fighting for democracy, what does that democracy look like? I mean, are we just talking about like what your personal conception of America is? You know, because we all grew up with the fairy tales of America, the city on a hill, you know, a beacon to all the world, spreading democracy and just spreading democracy and freedom. But ultimately, the last 25, 30 years have shown a lot of us that, that is far from the truth. But I think a lot of us, you know, who haven't disengaged from the system in a meaningful way haven't really shed that delusion. You know, it reminds me of listening to, you know, like atheist call-in shows where the believer who's trying to convince the atheist runs up against cognitive dissonance of his own beliefs. And so some people are willing to sit there and actually listen and take something in. It doesn't mean people are going to change their opinion overnight about what they feel or believe, but at least they're willing to hear it out, whereas some people become immediately defensive and, I mean, verbally aggressive. And I feel like in a lot of ways, because democracy and, democracy and freedom are really just kind of tied to words and fluffery, that, you know, there's very few people who have really engaged with what democracy and freedom means. And especially from the point of view of people with whom democracy and freedom have never, ever really been a luxury. You know, I mean, as somebody who is a Chicano, who did not grow up in the culture, who does not, you know, I'm, as an adult, I'm learning how to speak Spanish. I'm learning how to speak Nahuatl. You know, I'm learning how to speak a little bit of Mayan, you know, because, you know, of where my, you know, where my ancestral roots come from. Somebody who doesn't, you know, who fits it phenotypically, sort of, but doesn't really embody it in a lot of ways, I experience much of the same racism that somebody who might be, you know, similar complexion or darker, somebody who actually speaks Spanish, somebody who actually, they experience that, I experience that racism in the same way. And it, in a similar way. And, what is that? I mean, how do you talk to somebody who is, you know, what they call that is a paper citizen? You know, how do you explain that to someone? How do you explain freedom and democracy to someone who's never experienced it like that? You understand what I'm saying? So anyway, the phone number is 503-231-8187. You know, wanting to have a good discussion tonight, talking to, you know, white brothers and sisters about, you know, what democracy are we really losing, and talking to my black brothers, sisters, and asking them, hey, black and brown brothers and sisters, what are your experiences with these 50-51 and hands-off marches, if you've been to them, and what are you doing in the community to address the things that you're doing, or what is your personal thing going on? Anyway, okay, all right, go ahead, caller.
Hello, you got me?
Yes, this is Ralph?
Yeah, you got it.
Okay, good evening, Ralph, how are you doing, man?
Pretty well. I tuned in when you were reading Kwame Ture's words, and so great show so far, love it.
Okay.
And I just heard that, like, can some random white person call in? And I was like, hey, I'm on my way somewhere, I'll give you a call.
Sounds great. All right, Ralph, what's on your mind, brother?
Well, you kind of, even between when you, like, asked the question for folks to call in and when I got through, you kind of answered the question for me.
Okay.
My take on democracy in the States, it's more personal, like you were describing. It's,
yeah,
like when I was at whatever...
Okay, yeah, so, okay, and it sounds like we have Dan on the line.
Yeah, that's too bad. He was just getting going there. But
yeah, I really like what he was having to say.
What do I think about democracy? Well, you know, I'll take you in a different direction here and see what you think. My dad passed away recently, and I inherited the manifest from the Cunard line, where my great great grandfather came in from Norway.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the only, like, ethnic trace that I can do with my family. I'm one quarter Norwegian. And they came in, and so this is a very proud thing. It's all framed, right? And mm-hmm. we think about coming to America as immigrants and all that. But, you know, they were given land in North Dakota that had just recently, like very recently, been taken away from Native Americans indigenous people here.
Yes.
You know, and I don't think that we're going to get to any place, you know, that we really want to be. If we really want democracy for everybody, and if we really want, if we want our privileges to be based on what we do and not who we are as an identity, as a white identity, not on the backs of others or taken from the land of others or actually the pollution of our Mother Earth and the way we treat this planet and the ocean and other animals and, you know, our brothers and sisters who are, and siblings who are, you know, creatures out here that we're all equal with. But if we want to do that, then we have to make reparations. Reparations, the root word is repair. And we have to look back, you know. I've been given a privilege because of that land that was given to my great-great-grandfather, right? And, you know, our great-grandfather, actually. And that meant that his son could learn mechanics. And then that meant that my father could go to Oregon State University. And Oregon State University is built on stolen land. And the opportunity to go to that university was not allowed for black folks or for indigenous folks, you know? We have to start realizing these things in order for us to build a democracy. And not just, again, that's what I loved about the Stokely Carmichael quotes, you know, is that about what he said at the very end about, like, if the poor are going to advance because we exploit somebody over another part of the world, let's say Gaza, for example, you know, I guess some people can sleep at night, you know, with that. And it seems like liberals and fascists can. But I think people who have a conscience, who care, who really want to, who care about the planet and the people, we need to do reparations. And reparations does do two things. It fixes things. And it also reminds us that we don't want to do these mistakes again in the future. We keep making the same, and you've already referred to this, the same things over and over and over and over again. I'm actually believe until those reparations are made that we won't see the repair. And I mean, and this is institutional reparations that need to be done and acknowledgement. And this is why they don't like woke. This is why they don't want, you know, black history taught in schools. This is why they fight against all that stuff. And, you know, honestly, it's true what we have with Trump and, you know, Bannon and Miller and all these fascists, it's bad. It's worse. I mean, there's no question, but it's just a regurgitation of colonialism, capitalism, the imperialism, all these systems of empire that have been going on. And we're just having another phase of it that's to the extreme. I don't see reformation as a way to get to. I see reparation as the way.
I agree. Hey, thank you for your call, Dan. I really appreciate what you had to say, brother. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your contribution. You know, I think that's a really good point. You know, Dan made a lot of salient points right there. You know, and one of them being that, like, you know, because, you know, when Stokely Carmichael talked about, you know, because like he was saying, you know, like exploiting the poor, because in this capitalist system, we're taught that somebody has to suffer, you know, that, oh, you know, it's not everybody's going to make it, you know, but it's like, but why? Why is not everybody going to make it, you know, and who is not everybody? Because, you know, we've seen throughout history, even within Europe, that, you know, like, you know, people talk about, you know, Malthusian practices, you know, where they talk about, you know, how, you know, you have to, you know, be like, people are going to, essentially eugenics, where, like, you know, there's too many people, we can't feed all the mouths, so some people just have to some people just have to go away. You know, there's people who promoted that while sitting on top of some of the like greatest hordes of wealth that we've seen in history. You know, John Malthus was a person of privilege. He was a white man who was sitting on top of a vast fortune, who was literally just watching poor and marginalized, you know, other white folks who are getting drunk and, you know, I guess being debaucherous, if you will. And he's talking about how, look at these dirty people. They don't deserve to live in the world that I live in. You know, there's not enough for everyone. And so, you know, and it's like when they say there's not enough, they're saying there's not enough for them to live in the way that they do and be able to help people, because they have plenty of money. They have plenty of money. The reason why we have so many poor people on these streets here in Portland is because we have wealthy enclaves in the west side. We have some wealthy enclaves in the east side. And then we have power structures that are built to protect the wealth that can only be doled out by charity, but resists actual expropriation. We could fix the homeless problem almost overnight here in Portland if we took the money from the places where it's being hidden, the places where they're not being taxed, and move it into the coffers of where it would be able to be put to use. But instead, we're taught that we need to rely on charity. And, you know, charity is top down, but we're talking about like expropriation, mutual aid, which is bottom up, and where we don't see the people who are suffering as our lesser, but we see them as our equal. You know, the people in your community include the people on the street, in the tents, the people who are living in their cars, the people who you see as drug addicts. They're all the people in your community, and most folks are about one paycheck removed from that. I can tell you, I myself am probably about in the same boat. And when we refuse to see those people as human beings who have stories and lives that exist outside of our own, we don't give them that due that they deserve. And it goes double if they're black, brown, queer, trans, you know, or triple if it even crosses over between multiple intersecting identities, if you will. So once again, this is Radio Zine. I'm Santiago Ortega coming at you from the KBOO studios. The phone number here is 503-231-8187. Just working to trying to get some conversation going. We had a really good conversation with Phil earlier, who had a lot of good stuff to say. We had the one brother Ralph, but he dropped a cuss word and you can't do that on the radio. So he was going somewhere and I appreciate his contribution. And then we had Dan who added his voice as well. And, you know, I'm just putting it out there for the white folks who are listening. What does democracy mean to you? Does democracy, like, is it something tangible that you can look at? Is it a feeling that you've been instilled with or that you've gotten? I mean, what democracy are we actually losing? And how would you explain it to a person who lives within the same sphere of this supposed democracy, and how would you explain it to them for those who have never gotten to really taste that democracy in the same way? And then for the black and brown folks who are listening, like, what is your experience with these 50-51 and hands-off protests, if you've been to them, and what are you doing in the community to address what's going on, if you are, or like, what's giving you joy right now? Like, how are you making it through this? These are things I want to know. Yeah, so I have another piece right here that I had another piece that I wanted to read here. These are some really good thoughts from Thomas Sankara of Burkina Faso, because Burkina Faso has been in the news lately about with their politics lately, so want to be able to talk about that a little bit. The letter? Okay, all right. The letter, you are on KBOO with Santiago.
Okay, it's A, like the letter A, but...
Oh, the letter A, okay, I'm sorry. My bad, it's all good. How are you doing, A?
I'm doing good. First time listener of the show. I just found myself driving around so I could keep listening. Yeah, I really appreciate the questions that you asked. Not white, I've got a white mom, so maybe I can chime in on a little bit of everything.
Okay.
I don't think that democracy has ever existed in a country that's been, you know, signed an indigenous blood. So right off the bat, I'm also questioning, like, what type of democracy are we fighting for and what does that look like for folks? Really appreciated your quotes on Kwame Ture. I think that when you were talking about the, polarizing.
Polarizing, yeah.
Like how liberals will kind of do this two-party, like they're defending the right to speak out, but then will backpedal on everything. And I'm always trying to figure out, like, what are especially white liberals afraid of losing?
Yeah.
You know, the things that they're afraid of with this with Trump are the same things that black and brown people, black, brown, trans, LGBTQ people have been fighting since the conception of this country. I find myself getting real angry when, you know, I hear people trembling.
Yeah, and I feel you on that for sure. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, please.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I feel you on that, because when you're reading the words of Kwame Ture, when you're reading the words of Thomas Sankara, when you're reading the words of, like, Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson, this is stuff that has already been addressed. These things that white liberals are feeling right now have already been addressed. It's just that it was being addressed from a community that didn't concern them. And so now we're all sitting on the precipice of, like, real fascism when it was already being detected 40, 50, 60, 70 years ago, even further than that, if you want to be honest, because we're talking about as indigenous folks and black folks, it's been since the beginning of the country. But nobody wants to hear it because in a lot of ways, just to address what you were saying, I believe it's like, it's a fairy tale, you know, like it's a feel good story that allows them to be able to sleep, because if they don't have that story, then they become disturbed. And it creates like a sense of uncertainty, and then they confuse uncertainty with anxiety and don't allow themselves to sit in the uncertainty and see really, like, what does that mean? You know what I'm saying?
Uncertainty is a good word, and one that this country loves to use when capitalism kind of comes at a standstill. That's when it's uncertain. Like when the pandemic hit, times of uncertainty. And it's like, yes, we're all living in a similar fear of not knowing what's going on. And I might even argue to say that for about a year before, you know, everything was at a standstill, we were maybe equal on the same not great terms, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then we saw how the pandemic was affecting black and brown people. People didn't have access to healthcare and so on, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then when after the murder of George Floyd, you start seeing Black Lives Matter signs pop up in white liberals' yards.
Yep.
And to be quite honest, those are the scariest and most dangerous white liberals.
Yeah.
The Karens that have the I love my Muslim neighbor next to their Black Lives Matter sign that lock the doors when a black person walks by.
Yeah.
That's 100%. Who I'm looking at. That's who I'm scared. Not the Proud Boys.
No doubt.
Those are the ones that I'm looking out for.
Yeah, no, I hear you. You know, there's a saying, you know, when they gentrified North Portland, they replaced black people with Black Lives Matter signs. So it's it's poverty tourism in a lot of ways. But you know, but people are raised in it and they don't know that. And when they come to realize that, it's kind of a harsh awakening. And it's just the tip of the iceberg, if we're being honest. But thank you for calling in, A. I really appreciate what you had to say. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful night. Yeah, so yeah, and that's the truth, because when we're talking about like how we want to see change in this country, like we have to look at it from the, you, like there's this atheist guy that I like listening to occasionally, and he says, like, he talks about this thought experiment, like, how would you redesign society if you didn't know where you were going to be placed in it? And that's a really good idea, because a lot of folks who are talking about saving democracy, they know where their place is. You know, they're trying to reorganize things in a way that doesn't affect their privilege. But at the end of the day, if we want to see equality, that means some people are going to have to gain, some people are going to have to lose. And it doesn't have to be this awful thing if you're willing to come to terms with the fact that, like, you're hurting somebody by having as much as you do. You know, it's yeah, you know, it doesn't, the things that you have don't exist in a vacuum. So once again, this is Radio Zine. You're talking to Santiago over here, listening to Santiago, and we're just having a discussion about about democracy. Okay. About democracy and how we're feeling for white folks on one hand and black and brown folks on the other. But so thank you guys so much. Thank you to Nate running the board. Appreciate you, brother. I want to thank Phil. I want to thank Ralph. I want to thank A and Dan and everybody who called in. You guys are amazing. Love your thoughts. Thank you so much. And we're gonna go out with some Chicano Power by The Midnighters. Just want to say all power to the people. Que viva la raza. You know, workers of the world, unite. We all got to get together somehow. And let's do it. Have a good night.
My name is TK Kapurura and I'm an immigrant from Zimbabwe. I'm the host of The Global Cell, which airs live in the air room the first Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. I host immigrants and refugees from various global spots. I like to bring out